The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Glory America, bonjour, hi Canada, Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway on the 14th day of December in the year of our Lord 2021. Good morning, get up, get going. Time for the rundown. Let's begin with the news that broke on Capitol Hill yesterday. Joe Manchin stopped in the hallway to talk to reporters. Financial Times headline, White House scrambles to salvage Build Back Better bill by Christmas. Now the Financial Times described it as a $1.75 trillion, it's not. According to the Congressional Budget Office, it's a $5 trillion bill if you do what all Congresses do, which is extend their one-year programs and blow through their deadlines unless they have sunsets in them. So it's not 1.75, it's $5 trillion, and that's backed up by the Penn Wharton School analysis. Again, if you say, oh, this is a one-year bill and we're going to end all these programs, we start. Yeah, it's $2 trillion then, but it's not. It's $5 trillion, and Joe Manchin stopped in the hallway. And according to the New York Times, he said that they need a pause for peace. He said that anything is possible here, and he's still engaged in conversations with the White House. But listen for yourself. Joe Manchin talking to CNN's Manu Raju yesterday, cut number 10.
Well, whatever we're considering doing or whatever Congress is considering doing, they should do it within the limits of what we can afford. And that means having a tax plan that's fair and equitable and keeps us competitive, but also makes everyone pay, especially the wealthy, pay their fair share, too. See what that spins off, and if that's in that 1.7 range, then we should be spending whatever in that range as far as I'm concerned. If it's whatever plan it would be, pre-K, child care, and end of what you call in-home care, then it should be 10 years. It shouldn't just be 1 year here, 3 years here, 5 years there, and that would be, I think it would be very transparent for the public to see exactly what they'd be getting for what we're spending for 10 years.
So you won't support it if these programs are temporary?
No, we're going to talk. We're still talking. I'm just, I'm listening to everybody, but, I'm just telling you, ask me about inflation is real. It's not transitory. It's alarming. It's going up, not down, and I think that should be something we're concerned about.
Inflation is real. It's not transitory. It's going up, not down. That's something we should be concerned about. And Senator Manchin does not care about the gimmicks, nor should you. This is an inflation-busting build. Yesterday, my friend Jerry Boyer told me, it's not hyperinflation until you get to 20% a month. Well, we've never had that in the United States, but we have had Carter-era inflation. It's going to be Carter-era inflation. It already is, and it's going to get worse if they pass Build Back Better. Yesterday, I gave an opportunity, and I'll open the phones now, 1-800-520-1234. If you want to tell me how inflation is impacting your life, 1-800-520-1234. COVID news. The Air Force has discharged 27 active-duty service members for refusing to get the COVID-19 vaccine. I am not myself a defender of this. They get honorable discharge under the NDAA. I hope they get honorable discharge. They did not volunteer at a time when COVID-19 was a mandatory vaccine. So I think that's mutatis mutandis, changed circumstances, and they ought to be allowed to leave in the absence of some irregularity with an honorable discharge because the circumstances changed. And a lot of people have very firmly held positions on this, and as Americans, we can respect them. But the president has the right to tell the military to get vaccinated. The Supreme Court yesterday denied the right of 20 healthcare workers in New York to defy the state's mandate for healthcare workers. And these 20 workers said, we're Catholic, we can't take the vaccine because it's related to vaccines developed by stem cell research on unborn babies. In fact, they did not present as Catholic organizations, and they did not actually reflect Catholic doctrine, which has no problem, none at all. The Vatican has ruled, take the vaccine, and the court declined to issue exemption to these 20 disparate individuals. Justice Gorsuch dissented. Justice Alito joined the dissent, would have granted cert. Justice Thomas would have granted cert. Some people have, I believe, erroneously read this as a hostility to religious liberty. I don't read that as a hostility to religious liberty. I read that to, we're not going to let random 20 people come in and claim that they're the Catholic Church exercising doctrine, because that it's not against people having individual and syncretic, idiosyncratic religious beliefs. It's just that we can't empower everyone to have their own religious doctrine and say you've got to pay attention to us. Sincerely held religious belief is part of the test. And then, you know, who else has it? How long has it been around? And how long have you held this belief? In the case of these cells are based on prohibited abortion-dependent research, it's simply not true. The people who are most concerned with that have said it's not true. That would be the Vatican and American bishops, and therefore the court declined to go forward. Those who are throwing up their hands and worried about this, I tell you, this is the best religious liberty court we have ever had. It will get better. ABC is not going to miss her shot when it comes up, but they're not going to get dragged into a premature firing of that shot. I told you about the Air Force members. In parts of the land, hospitals are dropping the COVID-19 vaccine mandates because some people will not get them, and those are people they need to come to work. And so they're dropping it, as good employers do. They're making a cost-benefit analysis. They'd rather have the risk of unvaccinated people in their healthcare facility and a nurse or a doctor or a custodian or whoever is working there than not have them. That's up to the individual business to make that calculation. There are some, I believe, liability risks from allowing unvaccinated people to be coming into a healthcare facility. Remember the old age homes that Andrew Cuomo had so many people killed accidentally by allowing people into them who had the virus. It's just not a good idea. I would not let an unvaccinated person work in an elderly home. Omicron wave in Great Britain, according to the Telegraph, is being driven by young, healthy, and vaccinated population. And it's huge. About 200,000 cases a day of Omicron in the United Kingdom. Expect that to double by tomorrow and to double by the next day. Not any deaths. Well, they have had one death, according to Boris Johnson. One death. It's having an impact on the Conservative government's budget. They have abandoned tax hikes, or at least Rishi Sunak, who is the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the Treasury Secretary of Great Britain, has said we're going to have to, people around him are saying, no tax hikes, not, we're going to have a rough fall. China has reported its first Omicron case as fear mount for supply chains, because China's going to end up there. But they don't screw around, right? They weld you into your apartment, because that's what dictators do. Meanwhile, documents published this morning in the Washington Post link Huawei, which was the target of Mike Pompeo, Robert O'Brien, Matt Pottinger, and others on Team Trump who were concerned about Chinese espionage. Documents link Huawei to China's surveillance programs. Oh, we knew that. We told you that. We've been telling you that for a long time. Keith Kroc is doing a little dance this morning, the Undersecretary of State who put together the clean 5G network. If you buy Huawei, you're just buying the stealing of your data and the observing of your people. The most alarming story of the morning, how Beijing influences the influencers. It's about Beijing using YouTube. If you're on YouTube and you see a YouTube influencer channel on China, that's not actually their channel. They're being paid and bought and paid for by the state, and they're being produced by the state, I read. The videos you watch on YouTube about China have a casual, homespun feel. But on the other side of the camera often stands a large apparatus of government organizers, state-controlled news media, and other official amplifiers, all part of the Chinese government's widening attempts to spread pro-Beijing messages around the planet. State-run news outlets and local governments have organized and funded pro-Beijing influencers' travel. These are Westerners, by the way, many Americans, according to government documents and the creators themselves. They have paid or offered to pay the creators. They have generated lucrative traffic for the influencers by sharing videos with millions of followers on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. With official media outlets backing, the creators can visit and film in parts of China where the authorities have obstructed foreign journalists' reporting. Most of the YouTubers have lived in China for years, say their aim is to cover the West's increasingly negative perceptions of the country. They decide what goes into their videos. They say, not the Communist Party. But even if the creators do not see themselves as propaganda tools, Beijing is using them as a way China's diplomats and representatives have shown their videos at news conferences, promoted their creations on social media. Together, six of the most popular of these influencers have garnered more than 130 million views on YouTube. Sympathetic foreign voices are part of Beijing's increasingly ambitious effort to shape the world conversation about China. The Communist Party has marshaled diplomats and state news outlets to carry its narrative and drawn out criticism, often with the help of armies of shadowy accounts that amplify their posts. In effect, Beijing is using platforms like Twitter and YouTube, which the government blocks inside of China, to prevent the uncontrolled spread of information as propaganda megaphones for the wider world. China is the new super abuser that has arrived in global social media, says a former content moderator for Chinese social media. Their goal is not to win, but to cause chaos and suspicion until there is no real truth. That's a Merry Christmas morning for you on The Rundown. Stay tuned to The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. Come, I'm Hugh Hewitt. He's David M. Drucker. You see him on all of the cable channels. He's the author of In Trump's Shadow, A Wonderful Christmas Present. He's at the Washington Examiner most days. He's on Twitter at David M. Drucker. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Hugh.
I cannot read Joe Manchin's comments or play his audio without concluding he is not buying into Build Back Better. What say you?
Well, I tend to agree with you. You know, I'm in a business where I hate flat-out predictions because that's when I don't look so smart. But, look, Joe Manchin's been very consistent. You know, I would say initially, at the beginning of the year, I was skeptical because typically when a conference or a caucus in the Senate or in the House is this thin, the majority is this thin, the holdouts usually end up coming along after a lot of what turn out to be performative protests. But Joe Manchin has had a lot of substantive disagreements with this bill as it has unfolded. He has been very consistent. He's taken it this far. I don't see why all of a sudden he's going to change his mind, especially, you know, unless they just made some radical changes to the bill or certain significant changes, especially when you look at the polling in West Virginia. His voters are happy with what he's doing, and especially given on top of that, the fact that he, you know, is a politician in his 70s. I mean, he's been to the circus, been to the mountaintop, and he's got nothing else he needs to prove other than if he does choose to run for reelection again. It just doesn't make sense to me that he would talk himself into something or try to come up with some convoluted reasoning for legislation that he's been so patiently and adamantly opposed to.
You know, I think what you said is very important. He has no drive to be anything other than Joe Manchin. So he goes to see Joe Biden, who's, you know, 8 years older than he is or 9 years older. And he listens to the president and he patiently says, Joe, this bill is going to raise prices for everyone. I just had a COO or CEO of a trucking company call talking about his fleet of 8 trucks and the costs that have hammered him in the last 6 months. Nobody's inventing this, David, and Joe Manchin knows that. Nobody is inventing the inflation. It's real and it's horrible.
It is. It is. And look, I think this is one of the biggest problems the Democrats have had, in addition to some problems that, look, you're just going to have and maybe you couldn't do anything about no matter what, is that voters don't believe they are doing enough to tackle the problem that they think is the biggest problem, and that is inflation. So some of how they have answered this is to say that, well, if we pass this Build Back Better package, it will actually help the economy and therefore help inflation. The problem is people don't see the connection. I don't even know if it's so much that, you know, people are economists and saying to themselves, well, if you flood the economy with more federal dollars, it's not going to help inflation because that doesn't help inflation. I don't think they see the connection between the programs that this bill would create and expand and reducing the cost of goods when they go to the grocery store or, you know, for businesses, you know, the costs associated with running their business. And that's really the biggest political problem they're having. There is of course, the economic issue of you know, trying to flood the economy with more federal dollars in the midst of a 40-year high in inflation.
It's crazy. Now, Rita Braver sat down with Jill Biden yesterday for a long interview, but also had a couple of questions with the president, one of which was on Afghanistan. I don't know if you've heard this yet. Let's play his answer to Rita Braver's question about Afghanistan. CBS correspondent Rita Braver, cut number 4.
certain things that are just, like, for example, Afghanistan. Well, I've been against that war in Afghanistan from the very beginning. We're spending $300 million a week in Afghanistan over 20 years. Now, how do you know, everybody says you could have gotten out without anybody being hurt. No one's come up with a way to ever indicate to me how that happens.
Does that sound in command of the Afghanistan issue to you, David?
Well, that doesn't sound like somebody who is taking responsibility for what happened or even attempting an adequate explanation for what everybody saw on their television screens.
It's a very bad moment.
Yeah.
You expect the president to say, I was against the war. I said I campaigned on getting out. Getting out was more difficult. The loss of life was horrific. I wish we had done it better, and I am sorry, but we needed to get out. I mean, it's not hard to say, but if you're older and you're slower and you're infirm, let's play it again for people. This is Joe Biden and Rita Braver last night, cut number 4.
Certain things that are just, like, for example, Afghanistan. Well, I've been against that war in Afghanistan from the very beginning. We're spending $300 million a week in Afghanistan over 20 years. Now, how do you, everybody says you could have gotten out without anybody being hurt. No one's come up with a way to ever indicate to me how that happens.
It's almost 5 different mistakes in 20 seconds, David. Last 30 seconds to you. Do you think he's running for re-election?
I think he plans to run for re-election. I think whether he does or not, we still don't know. Look, I want to say on Afghanistan, that answer from Joe Biden doesn't strike me. The problem isn't that he's older or infirm. The problem is that is the Joe Biden outlook on foreign policy. If you look at how he treated Iraq when he was vice president and before. And so this is to be expected. It's just not. It doesn't work when you're president.
I think the age enters into it because he begins 3 different answers in the course of 20 seconds. Having been asked, I don't know what Rita Braver asked him, but I don't think it was responsive to her question. I'm not sure. David M. Drucker on Twitter. Thank you, David. In Trump's Shadow. Great book for Christmas for people who study the Republican Party, which is about.
It really
don't go anywhere. Coming up, hour number 2, straight ahead. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway, joined by Byron York of the Washington Examiner. He's also, you see him on Fox News. Good morning, Byron. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Doing well, thanks.
Our mutual friend Joe Concha, 10 hours ago, put out the Friday night ratings of cable. Now, I don't normally pay attention to the cable ratings, but I've started to appear on Brett Baer Special Report, and I know you work over there. I've left NBC. And I'm curious, the only CNN program, no CNN program broke 700,000 viewers on Friday. None. Every hour of this show has more than 700,000 listeners, Byron. I cannot believe this. What has happened there?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. Joe had retweeted a Twitter site that sends out a lot of the cable news ratings. And the ratings for Friday night were really not all that unusual. 9 out of the top 10 programs were Fox News. Number 6 was the Rachel Maddow show on MSNBC. Sometimes there are 2 MSNBC shows in the top 10, but that's a pretty accurate picture of what it looks like all the time. The highest rated CNN show was 27th, Anderson Cooper's show, at 8 p.m. That's been the same for quite a long time, usually the highest. When Chris Cuomo was there, the highest rated CNN show was maybe 24th. I've always wondered, and I have to say I haven't done any reporting, I haven't looked into this, but I've always wondered why CNN doesn't want to do better. I mean, ratings are the measurement of your success.
Apparently not. I was the lowest rated host in the history of MSNBC with my 7:30 a.m. Saturday show, which Phil Griffin, obviously intended to kill it immediately.
Are you still doing that show today?
No. I had 75,000 people.
To do with being the lowest rated show on television?
No. It was a Saturday morning show after an infomercial. I found it very amusing, actually. They were contractually obliged to give it to me, and they did, and it lasted a year. And we had newsmakers, et cetera. But 7:30 a.m. on Saturday morning, it just wasn't. But I got 75,000 people. I'm looking at these numbers. If I can get 75,000 people on a Saturday morning after an infomercial, what are they doing over there? Are they driving people away? Are they positively angering them?
Here's one thing that I think gets overlooked some. Now, I'm a Fox News contributor, and everybody can take that into account with what I say. But people at CNN or MSNBC or their advocates would say, well, Fox is this right-wing, pandering to this right-wing audience. There are a couple of things. One, Fox gets more viewers in the middle of the political spectrum and on the left of the political spectrum than CNN or MSNBC get on the right of the political spectrum. And the other thing that I think that's been overlooked since the very earliest days with Roger Ailes is that Fox does TV better. I mean, they just produce better programs. And that's something that you really can't discount because that's what it is. People are watching television. And simply in terms of television producers and the production of the whole program that you as a viewer see on your television, they're just better at it.
And well, let me also say,
it's been a factor from the very beginning.
They also cover more interesting things. They are trying to beat the dead horse of the January 6th committee, and that horse is dead. The parrot is dead. Nobody cares. And yesterday, the big news is that Mark Meadows got texts from Laura Ingraham and Sean Hannity and a whole bunch of people saying, this is awful. Stop it. Get the president to stop the riot. Okay, that actually feeds the narrative that Mark Meadows was doing his best to tell the president what was happening and the president was not engaged with it for whatever reason, but it doesn't speak to a conspiracy. I mean, it's the opposite of what the narrative is. And in any event, when Nancy Pelosi tried to rig the committee, she killed its newsworthiness to people on the center and the right. Am I correct about that?
Yeah, several times in this process, this January 6th committee process, including last night, I have thought this would be so much better if there were some Republicans on it.
If there was conflict. If there was conflict.
Republicans would not control the committee because the Democrats control the House, so they'd be able to do what they want. But it would be better to have some dissenting voices. Now, obviously, you have Kinzinger and Cheney, who are Republicans, but they agree entirely with, as far as I can tell, everything Democrats want to do. And the idea of having a bipartisan committee has always been this idea that the parties have different views about some issues, so you would include different views. So I wish that they had different views. Now, as far as these texts that were released last night, all the attention paid to one from Laura Ingraham, from Sean Hannity, Brian Kilmeade, and then Donald Trump Jr. I mean, I couldn't disagree with a word any of them said. I mean,
no, it's exactly what you would hope. It's exactly what I was tweeting.
Yes. I was feeling exactly the same thing that day. I did not tweet text Mark Meadows, but I think most Americans felt exactly the same thing. So I'm not sure controversy is there.
There is no controversy. It's a kudos to those people who had the ability to get the chief of staff here and tell them. But okay, here's the problem. I look at these Friday night ratings, and they're all over January 6th. Joy's got 1,009,000 people. There are 330 million Americans. They're running with January 6th. What will it take for them to get a reverse demand signal that nobody cares? Because nobody cares.
Well, maybe the next election. I was just reading this morning. Rui Teixeira, political analyst, several years ago wrote a book called "The Emerging Democratic Majority," which Democrats took to heart and thought, "Wow, we're going to be in the majority from now on because of the growth of Hispanic voters." And this is great. And Democrats will just be in control from now on. And now he has a much different message. And I was reading a new piece he has written about the huge problem that Democrats have with Hispanic voters now. And amazingly enough, he's discovered that Hispanic voters care about jobs and the economy.
You know, I just had, Brian, did you listen, Byron, did you listen to the callers last hour? Did you tune in early enough?
I heard the trucking company.
That's the guy. Eight trucks. Every day it costs $60 more than it used to get those trucks on the road. The tires have gone. That's a real story. That's an actual honest-to-God story about what is a small trucking fleet doing and what will Build Back Better do to them. And nobody covers it. I just think it's crazy.
You're a Democratic strategist, and you say, I, Mr. Democratic strategist, have assumed that Hispanic voters are just in the bag for Democrats.
Yep.
And that is not at all the case anymore. The world has changed dramatically, actually, since the days of the autopsy, which was the study that Republicans conducted after Mitt Romney lost to Barack Obama in 2012. The world has changed, and I can no longer take Hispanic voters for granted. And amazingly enough, they're concerned about what everybody else is concerned about, which is jobs, the economy.
If Brian hadn't hung up,
the United States.
Brian had to go talk to a worker. What I was going to ask him is, tell me about your eight drivers. Who are they? And we're going to find high school educated, maybe not, but probably certified drivers of a vast array of, you know, they don't care who drives a truck. Do you care who drives your truck to the grocery store? No. You're going to find a vast array of socially divergent people with backgrounds across the board, all making a good wage, but they're all getting pushed by inflation. And that's what's going to kill the Democrats. Last word. And Byron, take a minute and a half. I don't think the Democrats have any idea what is coming their way.
No, you know, it's interesting. So many of these trends seem to be set. We all, and, you know, I was listening to David Drucker being cautious. You know, he didn't want to predict things. And I think that's wise because unexpected events can happen. But I remember having lunch with John Boehner in 2010.
No, you haven't.
Several months before the election. Now, in that election, Republicans would win a smashing victory, take control of the House. I think they picked up 63 seats.
Correct.
And Boehner, who, of course, was having a glass of red wine, said,
of course.
Look, and this was allegedly off the record. At the time it was. He said, look, it is baked in the cake. We're going to win. And he had a couple of aides with him who kind of tutted him. Oh, don't say that. Don't say that. And he said, it is. It's baked in the cake. And this was months ahead of time.
And I think
I don't think we're quite there yet, but we're getting close.
I think it's there because I've been following the redistricting, and they're making safe districts safer, and swing districts are less swingier. So they will be absolutely, the ones that are swinging will be flipping saloon doors, and they're going to flip to the Republicans. Byron York, always a pleasure. Follow him at Byron York on Twitter. Read him in the Washington Examiner. Watch him on Fox News. Come right back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Hi, it's Hugh Hewitt. If you're buying gold, do it from Birch Gold. You can find Birch Gold at HughGold.com. I'm glad that they're sponsoring the podcast, but more importantly, I'm glad you're looking at making sure that your investment portfolio is diversified. Wealth is made in concentration and preserved in diversification, and you should diversify a part of your portfolio, 5 to 10% in gold. You can do that by rolling over a portion of your IRA or 401k into a gold and silver and other precious metals depository maintained by Birch Gold. Or you can just buy gold and put it in your safety deposit box. Either way, do it from Birch Gold, which you can find at HughGold.com, or text my name, Hugh, to 474747. That's HughGold.com, or text my name, Hugh, to 474747. Now enjoy this podcast.
I saw three ships come sailing in on Christmas Day, on Christmas Day. I saw three ships come sailing in on Christmas Day in the morning.
Welcome back, America. No better song for Christmas to greet Admiral James Stavridis, retired former head of NATO, former head of U.S. Southern Command. Admiral Stavridis joins us. Good morning, Admiral. How are you?
Doing great. That's a great sea shanty you played there.
Yeah, we like that. Admiral, I want to begin with the story from the Wall Street Journal this morning that the Air Force has discharged 27 active duty service members for refusing the COVID-19 vaccine. What do you think of the policy? What do you think of their discharge status and what it should be? The NDAA says they will get honorable discharges, but that hasn't passed yet.
For starters, when I joined the military, Hugh, I had to take 9 different vaccines. When I prepared to deploy to Desert Storm, I had to take 11 anthrax shots. The culture, the settled law here is very clear. Active duty military, because they are potential forward deployers, have got to take these vaccines. So they have to be capable of doing that. You couple that with you're getting a direct order from your chain of command. In my view, it is absolutely a requirement for every member of the armed forces to take this vaccine. It's the right thing to do, not just for yourself, but for your shipmate to the left and right of you in that destroyer. You are protecting the force by doing this. So I take a pretty direct approach here, and I think the services will as well. Now, having said all that, should there be some counseling, some leadership applied? Should we give a little bit of time here? I think so. And I think where this will land, Hugh, and we've seen this in other big organizations like the airlines or the medical world, when people are given a date certain by which they have to get the vaccine or lose their job, i.e. get discharged in a military context, we tend to get 98%. And I think that's probably where we'll end up with the military. Can we run the force on 98%? Yes. Don't like losing anybody who's a good performer, but if you can't do the basics, and I look at this as doing the basics of your duty, I don't think you belong in the armed forces, so I support a discharge. And frankly, I would support not an honorable discharge, but in what's called an honorable under general conditions, which is one click lower, to recognize the fact that you have disobeyed direct order and failed to accomplish your duty.
Well, that's interesting. I support the legislation because of the mutatis mutandis concept of changed circumstances. When you sign up for the military, you know you're going to get the anthrax shots. For those who are in the military and for whom this has become a political issue, it's a changed circumstance. I prefer a quiet departure of those who will not comply. But that's an interesting perspective. I didn't know about that step lawyer. Let me then change to Ukraine, about which I had a number of conversations this week. In 1994, what were you doing in the Navy in 1994, Admiral?
I was in command of an Arleigh Burke destroyer, 350 people under my command, brand new ship. We were deployed to the Eastern Mediterranean, went up into the Black Sea, and then we also went to the Arabian Gulf.
Oh, that's very interesting, because that brings you close to Crimea then, if not into port in Crimea. In 1994, the newly independent Ukraine had its territorial integrity guaranteed by the UN and the United States. So when President Biden said this week Article 5 doesn't apply, I understand what he means. It doesn't apply. But we gave them a guarantee, and they gave up the third most nuclear weapons in the world. What message does it send if we do not help them now?
It sends a very bad message, and that bad message is compounded by the way we withdrew abruptly from Afghanistan, leading a great deal of chaos in our wake. When you put those two things together, it does not inspire confidence in the guarantees of the United States or the West. So I strongly support enhanced intelligence, cyber capability, lethal weapons to the Ukrainians, a NATO training mission in Ukraine. All those things are anathema to Vladimir Putin, but he needs to see that if he attempts to attack Ukraine, it's going to be like trying to eat a porcupine. Bears don't eat porcupines because the spines are very difficult for them to digest. Let's make it a hard problem for Putin.
And I got to say, if we don't, we'll never get anyone to denuclearize again. Our guarantees. It happened to Gaddafi. It's happening to Ukraine now. Now I want to go to China, Admiral. There are 3 stories, one from the Foundation of Defense and Democracy on the Confucius Institutes, troublingly reported this morning. It's a brand new study over at FDD.com or FDD.org. We ordered many of them closed. They didn't close, or they shape-shifted. They're still there. A second one, the Washington Post this morning, documents link Huawei to China's surveillance programs. And a third in the New York Times, massive and interesting, how Beijing influences the influencers. Any Westerner in China is being encouraged to do YouTube channels and supported by the state provided they put the right kind of stuff up on their YouTube channel. China is omnivorous on social media, Admiral.
They are, and they're very capable, and it's part of their approach. They are going to internationally push this Belt and Road Initiative and try and connect with as many countries are willing to accept economic support from them. Within China, they have constructed the ultimate interagency, if you will. All the elements of government are fully integrated and work together. And perhaps most concerningly for us, here's your point, they are highly, highly capable at what could be called broadly strategic communication, meaning how they depict the state, how they depict it internally and externally, how they harness social networks, how they control massive amounts of data. All of those things are tools that authoritarian states have always had, but now they're enhanced by the power of cyber and these social networks. So there should be nothing surprising in any of those three stories to those who have been watching China.
Now, you are a China watcher, and I have been doing my homework not only on this Foundation of Defense of Democracy story, but generally on, okay, we all know that General Secretary Xi is running in it. Who's his right arm? Turns out it's a fellow named Wang Huning on the Committee of Seven, who is their Kissinger. Have you ever met Mr. Wang?
I have been in a room with him. I was not a direct interlocutor, but I have been around him as well as around President Xi.
What do you think of his reputation? I mean, it's very intimidating. He has quite a brain, quite a grasp, quite a grand theory.
Correct. And I think it's very true to say that China watches us and China knows more about us than we do about China. And we need to remedy that. We need to rely less on a handful of Henry Kissinger-like figures and more broadly understand, read about, appreciate the challenges that are ahead in China. And so I would say it would start with creating a national strategy to deal with China. This is something the Trump administration worked on but never quite completed. The Biden administration is working on it. It needs to be a broad-based strategy that brings together military deterrence, our activities in space, our activities in cyber, our economic interrelationships. When do we use trade and tariff sanctions? Human rights, the strategic communications from our side on all this. We need a strategy. We are not good at writing strategies and thinking long-term. Xi, Wang, the Chinese Communist Party, they think in decades and indeed in centuries. We need to begin doing the same.
You know, Admiral, yesterday I was talking with a China scholar who knows Mr. Wang and knows of Mr. Wang and other people who have been familiar with the FDD report, et cetera. And I asked them, are there any novelists at work on bringing the American public's attention what is going on in China in the way that Le Carre and did for Russia and Danny Silva has done for Israel? And said, well, James Stavridis and Elliot Ackerman wrote 2034. That's it, Admiral. That's it. 2034 was the only book that we can come up with that contemplates how the CCP's elite think. That's a big strategic. I know you have sequels coming up. I know you're at work on them. But is there anything else that occurs to you where anyone has tried to fictionalize and thereby popularize an understanding of the CCP?
The best I've seen is by a Chinese-American writer named Ha Jin, H-A, new word, J-I-N, Ha Jin. He won the National Book Award for a brilliant novel called Waiting.
And I read that. I read that on your recommendation. That's a fabulous novel.
Fabulous. Look at his later works. That came out over a decade ago. He's written several books since then that explore the Chinese-American experience, but also reflect back on Chinese Communist Party. Of his later novels, I'd recommend, it's an interesting title, War Trash, and it is about China and Taiwan and the nationalists and the Chinese Communist Party. Very, very good.
You know, I'll tell the people about Waiting. What it really does convey is in the title. It's about the pace of change in China and how it can be quick and slow and how the Chinese people are used to endure. Is that a fair takeaway, Admiral?
Another way to think of it, yes, it is. Another way to think of it is, again, the Chinese think long term. Deng Xiaoping was asked once, how were events unfolding in China during his time, sandwiched as he was between Mao and Xi? And Deng said, he was referring back to the French Revolution, and was asked, how did that impact the world? And he said, it's too soon to tell.
Yeah,
150-year event. Previous.
Zhou Enlai used a similar line with Nixon at one point. You know, they are very long range, but Mr. Wang is a new personage about whom we should know more. And I think 2034 is a great present, along with the Sailor's Bookshelf. I want to give you a plug as people do their Christmas shopping. How's it selling, Admiral, the Sailor's Bookshelf?
Doing well. It came out number one on Amazon in the naval military category. So that's a great start for a book that focuses on the oceans and the seas. And as you know, it's a compendium of 50 different books, snapshot of each. Additive, it brings an understanding of the oceans of the world.
Now, as a civilian with a side family connection to the Navy, congratulations on Navy winning. But I must say, what I like the most is Commander Bourgeois' son, 6-year-old son, being in the locker room with the Navy players after the game.
Yeah, we talked about him. He was a remarkable surface warfare officer who then became a SEAL, a storied career. We will miss him deeply in the Navy.
Admiral, great to speak with you. Have a great, great week. We'll talk to you again next week as events are unfolding quickly in Europe. I always will check in with the former Allied Supreme Commander of NATO. Thank you, Admiral Stavridis. Time for me to tell you about this, relieffactor.com. You know, I've never sent the Admiral any of this. Maybe I should, because he always gets followed by a relieffactor.com embedded ad. They are a sponsor of the show. They have been for, 9 years. I take it every day because I try and make 1,000 miles a year. I'm going to come up short because of this stupid toe. I'm really angry about that. I haven't missed 1,000 miles in many years, but I'm going to come up short because I'm losing December. But I don't feel bad about it physically because I'm still taking my relieffactor.com. And D. White from D. Witt said to us, our house is aerobically inclined because it's a townhouse, right? And so you go up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. And so I think he's going to come to the studio eventually, but he might be too exhausted by townhouse. In Minnesota, they spread out across the plains. They have these vast expanses of tundra, and they just kind of live out on the tundra. And they're not used to going up and down. They just get their sleds and they go across the tundras. So that's a little bit different. I will be in Minnesota on Wednesday night. Check AM 1280 The Answer for details about the debate between Minnesota would-be governors on the Republican side. I'll be moderating that debate. Looking forward to it. Looking forward to be back in Minnesota. Cold. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway on this Tuesday morning. The Foundation for the Defense of Democracies has a new report out this morning that I want to bring to your attention. It's called The Middle Kingdom Meets Higher Education, How U.S. Universities Support China's Military-Industrial Complex. If you will only read the first 5 pages, you will understand that what China has been about for the past 2 decades in building their Confucius Institute has been ominous and malign. Author Craig Singleton, an adjunct fellow at the Foundation, joins me now. Good morning, Craig. Welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
This is a great report. I could not believe that although the number of Confucius Institutes declined from 113 to 34 over the years 2018 to 2021, it didn't really lead to a significant decline in Chinese malevolent activities. Explain why.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Our research report sort of started with a simple question, you know, what happens when a Confucius Institute closes? And what this report shows is that China is quite literally weaponizing higher education. Using Confucius Institutes as modern-day Trojan horses, the Chinese government actually managed to build a very intricate web of academic and research partnerships between America's top research universities and Chinese schools that have been tasked by the Chinese government to support China's military buildup. And when I say that, I'm referring to China's nuclear weapons program, its cyber espionage platforms, the PLA itself. And what's really fascinating is that these relationships persist long after Confucius Institute has been closed. So as you mentioned, even though 79 have closed in the last 3 years, and there are still 34, dozens of other relationships have persisted between schools that had a Confucius Institute and closed them. So it's sort of a never-ending means of access for the
Chinese government. Let's talk about
U.S. universities.
The tall towers of CCP influence in the United States are the 34 remaining CIs. Why have they not been closed, given what we know and given what Team Trump, Pompeo, O'Brien, Pottinger, Keith Kroc, and others did to bring this to light? And people like Jim Banks called up the University of Indiana and said, either it closes or you won't get any federal funding. So good for Congressman Banks. Why do these 34 remain open?
The reality is that Congress has sort of been unable to pass legislation that does that. There have been small efforts put forward by several members of Congress on both sides of the aisle to say, hey, look, we should probably close these things down when the FBI says that they are a direct threat to academic freedom and censorship. But these aren't things that can be done through executive order from the previous administration. And it's really a responsibility for Congress to sit, you know, get its act together and say, hey, we're going to pass legislation that not only says that these things need to be closed, but if you are a U.S. university that continues to host a Confucius Institute, you're not going to get U.S. government R&D funding or other U.S. funding to support your operations.
I also want people to know they can go find out what their alma mater is up to. Stanford, for example, still has an open Confucius Institute, but it's at its Beijing campus. We've got Emory University, which is open at Nanjing University. We've got the Chicago Public School District, the East China Normal University Opera. It's open. It's kind of stunning, Craig. Did you have any idea what you would find when you set out? The University of Toledo, of all places, and has one open in cooperation with Yanshan University.
Yeah, Ohio is actually a hotbed, which is sort of surprising. The same goes for Utah as well. 20% of all Confucius Institutes are actually located in the state of New York, which is fascinating, just from a breakdown. They're spread across red states, blue states, so they are sort of everywhere. I think what was most concerning is as we started to dig into the details, we realized that quite clearly U.S. universities had done no vetting or any due diligence on their Chinese partners. Everything contained in our report that lists how schools are involved in China's nuclear weapons program, some of them actually even build China's nuclear warheads, all of that's available on the Internet. So the only thing that was required for these U.S. universities to sort of do a little due diligence was a Google search, and they didn't even do that. And part of the reason is because they're not required to. At present, U.S. universities don't need to coordinate any of these activities with federal or local authorities. They're not required to do due diligence. They're not even under requirement to sever ties with these Chinese universities when the U.S. government itself has said that they are a threat to U.S. national security. All of that's got to change.
Craig, I have you watched The Americans, the series?
Of course.
Okay, that's my life in the early 80s when I was a special assistant to two attorneys general. I used to get the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act applications, vet them on the final step, and give them to General Smith or General Meese to sign. And I was discussing this with my old DOJ colleague, Dwight Rabus, who's visiting. And everybody knew that the Soviets, the Cubans, the East Germans were around. And the country knew it, and the Americans capture it. I don't think anyone gets what the CCP is up to, do you?
I don't think so, especially not the scale. I think as you're looking back through the Cold War, maybe you had a few dozen Soviet students over here. There are hundreds of thousands of these students, and not all are malign. But what we do think is that from a scale perspective, it's sort of unmanageable. And the other challenge is it's not necessarily a law enforcement issue. These Chinese students who are here on grants from the Chinese government to learn about physics and then to go back and build nuclear weapons, they don't need to commit any crimes here in the United States. The Chinese government doesn't sit there and hem and haw about what's classified or unclassified. To them, just gaining foundational knowledge that can be harnessed to support its military modernization is valuable, which is why the Chinese government has these massive grant programs that sponsor promising STEM students from China to come over to our best schools, get the best education, and then go back and build nuclear submarines like they do for Texas A&M's partner.
Craig, do you know Wang Huning?
Yes.
Okay, not many people know about him. I've been doing my work on him. Is he in charge of this? I mean, because he's the big brain of China. Is he in charge of this? I mean, this is such a successful development of sources, penetration of the United States society. He came here in 1989. Is he the architect of this?
It's actually Xi Jinping himself. You know, he's given numerous speeches where he has talked about this idea of military-civil fusion. It's sort of the idea that you're going to, China can acquire the world's cutting-edge technologies, including through theft, to achieve military dominance. And that requires a heavy reliance on China's civilian universities. About 90 Chinese civilian universities have been tapped specifically by the Chinese government to support China's military buildup. Only 90 of 3,000. So we're really talking about a scalpel, not a sledgehammer. But it is something that the Chinese talk about openly in their speeches and Chinese media. It's only a surprise to us because we're not spending enough time to really to track the issue.
Now, you know, today your report comes out on an interesting day because the New York Times has a huge story on how China manipulates YouTube. And the Washington Post has a huge story on how Huawei is a forward facing arm of the Chinese government. Are we at a critical mass moment where wake up occurs and the United States turns to its self-defense?
I would like to think so. I mean, we've given a lot of attention recently, I think, just as a society to understanding links between U.S. companies that may or may not be operating in parts of China where there are there's modern-day slavery or other human rights abuses. The conversation hasn't necessarily focused enough on higher education. And that's just an area where I think some legislators, others in politics, are a little nervous to sort of go against the higher education lobby. It's very powerful. They have a lot of money. But I do think that reports like the one that we put out sort of shine a light and say, look, we're not saying that all academic partnerships are bad, but let's have some common sense guardrails. Should a U.S. university that receives millions of dollars from the U.S. government to work on classified research also be able to have a research or academic partnership with a Chinese university that builds nuclear submarines? I think the average person, the average voter would sit back and be like, no, that doesn't make a lot of sense. But I think we're seeing a lag between legislation and sort of the information coming to light about how China has weaponized our society.
Well, your monograph, The Middle Kingdom Meets Higher Education, is by Craig Singleton. That's who I'm talking with. And I'm sure Jim Banks and others in Congress, I'll be talking with Senator Cotton about this shortly. I am curious, what is the reaction of the CCP to your report, Craig?
They're not too happy. So they issued a formal review in Global Times, both of our report and in our global chairman, Matt Pottinger, who I think your listeners all know. So we are starting to see that we're obviously getting a little bit of their attention. Folks like Senator Cotton, you know, one of the schools in the reports in his state, and we've raised it with his staff recently, and I think they're going to take some real action. But even Admiral Stavridis on the show today, he's affiliated with Tufts. Tufts is one of those schools that maintains an academic partnership with a Chinese school that builds all of China's UAVs. So once again,
well, I'm a tenured member of Chapman. How did we do?
You're not on there, so you're safe for now.
Whew. Okay. You know, I was worried I didn't get a chance to go through the whole thing. The Middle Kingdom Meets Higher Education is available at FDD.org, or you can just remember Craig Singleton, also on Twitter, and I have tweeted out both his Twitter handle and the link. Craig, this is great work. May it travel far and fast. We need it to. Thank you, Craig Singleton. The Middle Kingdom Meets Higher Education. I'll be right back, America, on the Tuesday edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined now by United States Senator Tom Cotton. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, Hugh.
I am curious about your reaction to the text that Mark Meadows received from Laura Ingraham, Sean Hannity, and others. I would occasionally text Mark Meadows. I didn't do so on January 6th. But I think these texts are consistent with what I would have texted him, which is, do you see what's going on? Stop it. Why is this news?
Hugh, I haven't seen those text messages. I guess they were just reported this morning. But I wouldn't want to comment not having seen them.
Okay, you'll end up saying the same thing I did, which is, why is this a story? This is what you would expect people who know Mark Meadows to text him. Senator, I want to turn next to three stories on China. One is in the Washington Post, and it reports that the Chinese are very, very much in Huawei's shorts and They're using Huawei to hack everything. The second from the New York Times reports that China is very much into YouTube influencers who happen to be American or Westerners living in China and are paying them to put out propaganda. And the third is a brand new report from the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies on the so-called Confucius Institutes and how they're closed but not closed, and 30-plus of them remain open, and they're all malign. It's a lot of bad news for China this morning, Senator.
Yeah, Hugh, and none of that news is surprising. I've been raising the alarm on these points for many years. Huawei in particular has clearly been an arm of the Chinese intelligence services going back a decade. That's one reason why I work in Congress with the Trump administration to try to impose the most severe sanctions possible on Huawei to, in effect, put it out of business. And those have had a significant effect. Huawei's revenues have plummeted. Its sales of smartphones, which it uses to underwrite its infrastructure systems, which are designed to help spy on other companies and other countries, have collapsed this year. Now's the time to go for the jugular and put Huawei entirely out of business, Hugh. The Biden administration needs to continue that front. The other 2 points, Hugh, I'd say are part of a broader issue of what I call the China lobby. There is a vast network in American society of de facto lobbyists for the Chinese Communist Party. And it's not just who you might think, Hugh. It's not Wall Street bankers who've gotten rich off of outsourcing, or multinational corporations like Apple, who make so much of their product in China, or businesses like Disney and the NBA, who are desperate to get access to the Chinese market. It's university presidents in small towns across America who get money from these Chinese Confucius Institutes, or who get lots and lots of full freight tuition paying Chinese nationals. It's anyone who's outsourced even the smallest part of their manufacturing on a sole or even limited source basis to China. It's local officials, Hugh, governors, state elected officials, state legislators, county and city mayors, who are always hopeful of landing the next big super project through their economic development efforts from Chinese sources. There is a vast China lobby in this country. Many people don't even realize they are acting as de facto lobbyists for the Chinese Communist Party. That's one reason why it's so important to pursue what I've called strategic decoupling, to cut off China from critical parts of our economy, to diminish its influence in our society, and to reduce its role and influence in our politics, which right now are serious, growing, and a threat to our national security and our prosperity.
I don't know how anyone can miss three things. New York Times, Washington Post, Foundation for Defense of Democracy, all pointing to the malign efforts of the CCP to influence American politics. And I see behind it the hand of Wang Huning, who is their brilliant Kissinger, who has been there through three general secretaries and is a giant intellect and a formidable adversary. What I don't get, Senator, is where is the Bureau? I asked the author of the Foundation of Defense Democracy study if he'd watched the Americans, and he had. Now, you won't remember the Americans. You're too young. I don't even know if you were born when I was working for Attorney General Smith and Meese, and the FBI was all over the Soviets and the East German and the Cubans that were working in the United States that the Americans captures quite nicely. Is the Bureau doing counterintelligence, domestic counterintelligence with the CCP in anything like the level they need to be doing?
They are pursuing it, Hugh, but not at the volume necessary, just because the volume of Chinese espionage in this country probably surpasses anything we ever saw from Soviet Russia. Partly that's just a function of the size of China, its population, and the size of its intelligence services. It's also a function of how Chinese intelligence works. They're not just running agents out of their embassy in Washington or consulates around the country. I mean, Chinese nationals on campuses across the country are de facto and sometimes explicit agents of Chinese intelligence, monitoring, for instance, Chinese dissidents who are protesting the Chinese Communist Party, or Hong Kongers or Uyghurs who are part of the diaspora but still have family back in the grips of the Chinese Communist Party. The threat is present in almost every community, certainly every campus, and most critical companies as well. The FBI is working this problem. They could do more. You know, Hugh, if they weren't spending so much time investigating parents at school boards or kicking down the door of conservative journalists at 6 o'clock in the morning because they published unflattering material about Joe Biden, maybe they'd be able to put a few more agents
on the
Well, this is where I'm going. I also want to add the disclaimer, the caution, which I know you always add. I've heard Secretary Pompeo, Robert O'Brien add. We are not calling for a new McCarthyism. We do not want Chinese Americans to feel in any way disadvantaged. We want to protect the civil rights even of foreigners in our country. But the level of interest in this story and the level of government counter activity is so small compared to the threat. And our news media is focused. I just think the January 6th committee is kind of afterthought compared to Ukraine, China, espionage, hypersonics. And yet our priorities on the news side are completely back-assward, Senator.
Yeah. And let me make a very sharp distinction as well between Chinese Americans on the one hand and Chinese nationals on the other hand.
Yes.
The threat I'm talking about is Chinese nationals. I mean, these are Chinese citizens who are here on visas, sometimes maybe even here on open-ended indefinite visas, who are at major research universities, at our national laboratories, Hugh, who are working at some of the most cutting-edge technologies in the country. I think we should presumptively assume if you're a Chinese national and you are at a national laboratory or doing cutting edge kind of research, you didn't get here by accident. That turtle did not get on the fence post by itself. The Chinese Communist Party and the PLA play a large role in placing trusted sources or young people whom they are training for leadership or technological roles in the future. And we should scrutinize them very carefully. What the Chinese people need are more students coming here and studying things like the Federalist Papers and the Lincoln-Douglas debates. We don't need them coming here to study quantum computing and artificial intelligence.
Well, Senator, have any of the $7 to $10 trillion that have been spent in extraordinary spending, I put that into COVID relief, infrastructure, Build Back Better proposal, has any of it gone to expanding the FBI's counterintelligence capacity? Because we are talking about an exponential leap in capacity from the Soviet days to the CCP days.
Virtually none, Hugh. It's gone almost entirely last year to some emergency needs like the Paycheck Protection Program or other efforts to keep people working or connect to their job. But this year, under the Democrats, it's gone to almost nothing but social welfare spending. That doesn't just include counterintelligence, but our own collection of intelligence overseas, and certainly our military.
All right. So, Senator Manchin, your colleague, was in the hallway yesterday. I seem to hear him say, look, I'll spend $1.7 trillion over 10 years, but that's not what this bill is. And he may not even I mean, why can't people understand West Virginian? I get it. Why don't reporters get it? That's what he's saying, 1.7 over 10 years. And this is $5 trillion over 10 years.
Yeah, Hugh, I think a lot of those reporters in the Capitol hallways can't understand places like West Virginia or Arkansas because they've never been to. Yeah. If they did go, they went on like they were on an anthropological expedition. They don't understand a lot of the concerns that working folks in West Virginia and Arkansas have when inflation is at 40-year highs, Hugh. Senator Manchin's objection to this bill is fundamental. It's about the design of the bill. It is all a massive smoke and mirrors thing. It takes 10 years of tax revenues to pay for spending programs that only last a year or 3 years or 4 years or 6 years. He says that all those programs, if you're going to pursue them, should act 10 years. It should be even Steven on both sides of the ledger, 10 years of revenue, 10 years of spending. But Hugh, if that's the case, this bill cannot pass because, as you said, the actual cost of all that new spending, if you extend it out 10 years, is $5 trillion. $3 trillion added to the debt over the 10-year period ahead of us. And yet that is the fundamental design of the bill. There's no way to fix that. I know that Joe Biden and Chuck Schumer up there saying, this is a bill that doesn't exist, it's a fake score, it's a phony score. But if you listen to the Democrats, they are telling you, even as they pass programs that expire after 1 year or 3 years or 4 years, that they intend to come back and extend those programs indefinitely. This is the absolutely correct way to measure this, and Joe Manchin is right to be insisting that it be measured in a fair and accurate way over 10 years of spending.
Last question, Senator. By the time I talk to you next week, Putin may have invaded Ukraine. We guaranteed the territorial integrity of Ukraine in 1994. President Biden ignored that when he said it's not an Article 5 country. We signed that document. What does Tom Cotton think we should do if Putin invades again?
Well, the first thing we should do for you right now, and we should have been doing it yesterday,
is accelerating and expanding the kind of weapons that we're providing to the Ukrainian army so it can defend itself and defend its own territorial integrity. That's not just anti-armor weapons of the kind that President Trump started to send, but we need to expand it into air defense weapons as well, because Russia has obvious air superiority against Ukraine's military. The second thing we need to do is be concrete and specific about the kind of so-called severe sanctions that Joe Biden and Tony Blinken and others talk about. Vagueness will not work with Vladimir Putin. If Joe Biden, given his shambolic withdrawal from Afghanistan and his catastrophic misjudgments over 50 years, thinks that Vladimir Putin is scared of threats of severe consequences, he's sorely mistaken. We need to make those severe consequences concrete, like sanctions on their entire energy and gas, oil and gas sector, or sanctions on their bank sector, or cutting them off from the international banking system.
I need to play for you Rita Braver's question to Joe Biden yesterday on CBS News. Cut number four.
Certain things that are just, like, for example, Afghanistan. Well, I've been against that war in Afghanistan from the very beginning. We're spending $300 million a week in Afghanistan over 20 years. Now, how do you know, everybody says you could have gotten out without anybody being hurt. No one's come up with a way to ever indicate to me how that happens.
Senator Cotton, your reaction to that?
Boy, Hugh, there's a lot of videotape out there of Joe Biden in the first year of the Afghan war talking about how vital it was to our national security and how we'll never abandon Afghanistan as we did after the war there against the Soviet Russians. Joe Biden, once again, must be confused and forgetful about his long and ignominious record in public office.
I'll tell you, I remember him talking about the snows of the Khyber Pass and how he had to get people there before those passed. It was one of the weird moments of a very long and documented career. Senator Tom Cotton, thank you. Hope we talk again, and I hope Ukraine is still free next week, but you never know. I'll be right back, America. Don't go anywhere.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.